Hello, and welcome to The Spark. I'm Matt, and by the grace of the Nashville Public Library, I'm here to talk about the creative process and the joy of appreciating the creations of others. Thankfully, I'm not going to do it alone. Joining me today is a painter, illustrator, and graphic designer whose art show, Family Mythologies, is on view at Elephant Gallery in North Nashville until December 20th. It's Blythe Colvin.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah, this is fun. It's nice to formally sit down with you. You're always good at facilitating interesting conversations.
Thank you.
I'm excited to do it more.
So we're a couple days out from the show opening at time of recording.
Correct.
How does that feel?
It feels good. I think I feel a lot better this week than I felt last week pre-install when all of the works were sitting in my house ready to be viewed, but not quite on their stage yet. So I went and visited the install this morning, just made sure to spend a little bit of time with it as it has new life on the gallery walls rather than just creating them within my studio. And like I said, it just presents everything in a new light. So I'm feeling very excited, especially as of today.
Is it typical that you wouldn't take part in the install at all? You just sort of pass them over to the gallery?
Well, that's funny that you ask, because I took on a lot more stress of install for this show, I think, than I should have anticipated. I used to work at a gallery. And so for me, install day was a very stressful get up and get to the gallery as early as you can, make sure that the artists are pleased with how everything is laid out, and kind of get to doing physical labor of painting walls and patching holes, etc. But this time, since I'm just showing, I didn't really anticipate it to be as easy as it was. So I just brought the works to the gallery director, and he laid it out with me and made sure that I felt good about everything and felt confident about the flow and kind of the story of the show as you are walking into the gallery and walking through the gallery and then walking out of the gallery. And he made it really, really easy. So, yeah, I'm excited.
Good. I am as well.
Yeah.
I'm sure that this question is different depending on every gallery, every artist, every individual show. But was this a thing where you approached Elephant to do a show? Did they approach you? At what point did the theme become part of that conversation?
Great question. And it's interesting to backtrack and think about the beginning of the process, since I am kind of in the home stretch. Like I said, I mentioned I was working at a gallery. I had done a couple of smaller, not really like juried shows, more community oriented, local art gallery things. And I love the local space. I love local businesses. I always have. So it was a goal of mine to want to show at a gallery here in Nashville. I've lived here for, hard to say, almost 10 years now, feeling like almost a native. So I approached Alex at Elephant Gallery, and I didn't really approach him with the expectation of having a show or having a solo show whatsoever. I had just made a series of three artworks that I kind of felt had a narrative around them. Two of those artworks will be in the show because it ended up fitting the broader narrative and theme, which I'll get to. But I really just felt like I was at a place where I didn't work at the gallery anymore. I was making a lot of art and consuming a lot of art and thinking that I could kind of like go up to bat with other local artists. I felt like I was like good enough or confident enough. So I emailed him and I just sent him some works in progress of what the small three-part series was. And he was very receptive. He was very interested in them, which kind of boosted my confidence a little bit. And he told me, I would love to swing by your studio, which is in my home, so it's not very formal. So I kind of just like had him over and talked about these pieces with him a little bit. And he offered up the creation of the show and kind of giving me that pathway to explore a variety of themes. He told me that he wanted to see more work from me, which was exciting, and that he wanted to see a theme kind of come out of all of the broader things that I was working on. So a lot of the work that I had done that weren't necessarily related to that three-part series that I mentioned had to do with family ties and identity and growing up and nostalgia and things like that. So that was a pretty natural evolution, but very thankful that Alex saw that spark within me and wanted to give me the opportunity to follow that path for this solo show, which is Elephant Gallery. It's kind of their MO to show outsider art, quote unquote, or brute art, or people that are just less in like the academic gallery space.
Gotcha. Can you speak on brute art?
Brute art is the term, as far as I understand it, kind of the loose term for outsider art. And it's just art that I guess is less trained, in my understanding.
You're not entrenched in sort of the typical gallery spaces or art spaces as of yet.
Exactly. And I had worked, the gallery that I worked at was amazing and ambitious and wanted to be closer to what like a blue chip gallery is, which are very minimalist, very upper echelon galleries. Think Gagosian or David Zwirner, those kind of things. Those are bigger names in the art world, which I totally respect and I love. And they have really high level, high money clients. But I, just as an artist and a consumer, I appreciate folk art and more like bluegrass type themes, I would say. So I gravitated toward him and his gallery for that reason.
Makes sense. So talking about how, and we'll get deeper into this, the theme of the show is obviously family mythologies. You grew up in a very, very artsy household.
Extremely.
How have you sort of noticed that that affected your relationship to art, making or consuming, that it was like around you at all times?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. You're asking really good questions. You're making me think, which is always good. And this is something that is on my mind, I would say, often. I grew up drawing a lot, painting a lot, learning kind of the basics from my parents because they were just very encouraging of our creativity. So I would say I personally am long-term, yes, very like trained in art. Academically, I took the highest level art classes that I could throughout like middle and high school, which aren't super serious. But then in school, I also studied graphic design and I would take classes like painting classes and things like that where I just really did not like the curriculum. I kind of felt like I didn't have the desire to learn how to do an underpainting or learn about things like that, even though it's very important. I think it's really important to learn the basics and then learn how to break those rules beyond what they are and what they create for you. So I have a really highly trained background, but all of the stuff that I gravitate towards is more of the like less trained artists. So I kind of try to harness that like childlike spirit or kind of the conception of my art making as I move into the future. Like I am always wanting to go back to doodling and what I would draw as a kid and making things very like playful, which I'm not sure entirely if that answers your question directly.
No, I think so.
But I think we had like all of the basics very well given to us and then were able to learn, you know, to take which of those mattered to us and which didn't into our own practice. And I say our because my sister is also an artist and was trained kind of from a young age as well.
No, and it sounds like in terms of you talking about training and like having been trained being important, that that's a like cultivation of skills rather than being consumed with theory, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that all of that theory, color theory, learning how to mix paints, everything is extremely beneficial and everyone should learn it or at least be accepting of it in the beginning of their practice. But I don't think that what you have learned is the end all be all of your practice. So I'm always kind of trying to take those basics and break away from them while still appreciating them and finding them endearing.
Yeah, and if you've internalized them, then that sort of allows whatever is going to come out of you to come out in a way that is more cultivated without
Correct.
You having to think about it.
Correct. And then it just makes the emotion behind everything very authentic. You're not just improvising based on what you think you should be doing. I like to think about it in the context of music as well, because I am a huge music appreciator and listen to a lot of like jazz and funk and older stuff and newer stuff. And I think you can always tell the best musicians are the ones that grew up like playing in church or like playing in their basement and just like kind of grinding the basics into their brains. And then they get to live freely, creatively beyond that.
And something I've talked with a friend of mine who's an excellent cartoonist named Chris Schweitzer, how he doesn't really in like his graphic novels or comics doesn't really try to stick to any kind of act structure because like once you internalize enough stories, then you know how a given story should flow, especially if it's yours.
Totally.
Yeah.
And just letting that, like, I think the word flow keeps coming back to mind because that is very important in the way that you can like kind of feed yourself or fill your own cup up to kind of use a cliche phrase, and then eventually it will overflow. Maybe it's not as simple as that, but down to a basic, that's how I kind of like to think about it.
So you mentioned both your parents are graphic designers. You were like, your major was graphic design. Do you feel a designerly influence on your fine art, or is the fine art sort of in opposition to that part of your skill set?
I think when I was growing up, I always kind of saw them as two different worlds in a positive light. I thought they had very different structures to them as a practice, and the kind of people that gravitated towards one or the other were very different. My stereotype in my head of graphic designers is you read the brief, you're very detail-oriented, you're very, like, rule-driven, whereas I see in my head the stereotype of fine artists as being a little bit more eccentric, a little bit more spontaneous, a little bit quirkier, and I don't know when it started happening. It was many, many years after I left school that I started kind of viewing them as able to work together or, like, work in tandem. Because when I graduated, I was going into graphic design, and like I mentioned, I really disliked my painting classes, and I didn't see myself as wanting to make fine art. I saw myself as wanting to go very headfirst into the world of graphic design. But now that I know what the job market and the greater world is like, I don't know if my aesthetics necessarily match with contemporary graphic design in every way, and I think some of that is very, there's a huge trend of minimalism and just trying to boil things down to their core, which if you can do it in the right way, I think is really good. But I wanted to expand my worldview beyond that. So I wanted to try and start taking some principles of graphic design, like rhythm and scale and composition, and harnessing that practical side along with more spontaneous and childlike drawings that I had been working on. So I kind of intentionally tried to melt the two together, and in some instances it works, in some it doesn't. But I think instead of viewing them as two separate worlds, I'm trying to view them like as sisters, a little bit more cousins, or some kind of archetype that can work in tandem with each other.
Yeah. And you do still do some like brand identity and other like design work. So if you feel like your design doesn't fall into the sort of macro what graphic design is doing right now, does that come down to like finding instances where what the person wants lines up with your skill set in design?
I try to network a lot online just because I am kind of chronically on my phone due to my age and just who I am. So I do luckily find a lot of people through that, and I can present my most kind of like boisterous, colorful self confidently at the forefront. And then I think people who are into that a little bit more gravitate towards my work. And I've done some more minimal brand identities too. I think you can still be creative with minimalism, definitely. But it is always much nicer to work with a client who is a little bit more open-ended or just a little bit more empathetic and playful.
Mm. So talking about listening to lots of kinds of music, has there been anything specific spinning in your studio, anything specific you were listening to while working on the stuff for the show?
I listen to a huge variety of stuff. I wouldn't be able to pin it down to one thing that I'm kind of like studying in my studio per se. I do gravitate when I'm trying to get things done to a lot of pop music, just because it has a lot of energy and a lot of like emphasized feelings. When I'm trying to push things over the finish line, I love to listen to pop music because I just like to be loud and just get things done. It
kind of
feels
up.
Yeah, it feels like a your walkout song or something like that. Like you want it to be something that gives you energy and gives you ability. When I'm trying to be a little bit more introspective or come up with concepts, my fiance is a vinyl DJ, curator, and selector, so I typically let him take the reins on what we're listening to, but he's very attentive to like setting the vibe in the household. We've been listening to a lot of stuff without vocals the last couple of weeks, just trying to set more of like a sonic vibe in the house rather than like putting some sort of narrative over the household, if that makes sense. So a lot of ambient stuff, jazz, chill stuff is what I've really been gravitating towards, especially as it gets cold. But we also like a lot of classics, like listen to a lot of Sade, a lot of D'Angelo with his recent passing, huge R&B fans as well. So yeah, it's a huge variety.
It's weird how much season changing makes a difference in music listening specifically.
Yes.
Because as soon as it got really gray and cold, finally, and the summer's finally ended, my listening took a strong turn for like the indie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hayley Williams just released a kind of like very sad, like divorce type album. Perfect for the rainy week that we had. And I just love kind of getting, no matter what the emotion is, I love when it's extreme. So I love getting either super, super hyped up or kind of super in my feelings. Yeah, I'm an intense person, so I like that intensity.
Did you wind up with the flower-shaped vinyl from Record Store Day from like a decade ago?
I think I do have it somewhere.
I also gave mine away.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have it. The amount of boxes of stored vinyl
that's true,
that we
as
have
I
in our
that.
Household yeah. is kind of berserk. But yeah, she's always going to be somebody that's like super inspiring to me.
Briefly for the listener, there was a Record Store Day, oh my goodness, 2013 probably?
Yeah, like forever ago.
Long time ago. At Grimey's or
Old Grimey's location.
Old Grimey's on 8th?
Yes.
Where Paramore, in the lead up to or around the time of the release of the eponymous album, Paramore, did a Record Store Day show, the little acoustic set, just the three members at the time.
Iconic.
And there was a exclusive to Record Store Day flower-shaped pink vinyl that I think just had the ukulele tracks?
Yeah, it was all of the interludes from that album. And that album was my favorite at the time. I was so geeked when Kate gave it to me. I was like, wow, dream come true.
I think I remain an After Laughter man.
That's a good album. I can't pick and choose, but I do love them all.
I'm never angry when anything Paramore comes out.
Yeah. Nashville royalty.
Truly. So you talked about being in a period where you were both making and consuming a lot of art. How do you typically consume other people's art? Is that a lot of like looking through people's portfolio sites and Instagrams? Is that galleries?
Like I mentioned, I'm chronically online, so there's been a huge push for people to share their art on like Instagram Reels and stuff like that, which is always fun to see. I don't know if it's always like the best, but it's very accessible, which I think like accessible inspiration for me, it's just going to push me to the edge of wanting to like, if I see somebody else is sitting around making something, when I'm just on my phone, I'm like, oh, I got to get up and make something. Like, no matter the level of art, that is very inspiring to me. I do a lot of Pinterest pinning, searching, because you can get a wide variety of, like, very odd found imagery on there to more contemporary art and, like, so on and so forth. I also I love Thrift Books, the website, and sometimes I'll just go on there. And I had a period of time where I would just go on there and try and find, like, cheap art books, like, you know, easy enough to spend a couple of dollars to have an afternoon of inspiration. So I've got a Frida Kahlo book and a Noguchi book that I really, really like and have been studying a lot. And then, yeah, just going to galleries as well. I think after being in design school, art school, I was really burnt out on consuming art. So I didn't for a long time. And then I didn't make a lot just because I wasn't, like, filling my cup up. But now I'm not really the kind of person that wants to go to the art crawl on Saturdays and, like, be out and about with everybody else because it's more of a social event. But whenever Hayden and I visit new cities, it's always number one at the top of our list to find good record stores and good galleries, as well as, like, larger institutions, museums. A lot of college campuses always have awesome ones, like the one in Louisville, or, yeah, it doesn't matter where else. But that's always a priority of mine, is to try and view whenever I'm traveling.
Well, have there been any cities y'all have been to that felt particularly good for what you were looking for art-wise?
I think I've found, like, a surprising amount of good contemporary art in, like, the Mid-South. Like, the – now I'm blanking on what the name is of the museum that's on Louisville's campus.
The one on the campus? I don't know. I know the Speed is their, like, big museum.
Speed, yeah. Speed was surprisingly good for just kind of – I mean, when you think of at a glance, you think of the art world, you think of, like, New York, L.A. in America – I think there's so many institutions, and that's why, like, I love outsider art, but, like, the academic side of art is very important due to, like, funding and what people can show. So that museum was surprisingly really good to me. And then also we saw, I believe it was Asheville. We went to Asheville recently and other parts of South Carolina, Johnson City. We saw some good art there, which, you know, you don't really think of the Mid-South or, like, kind of the middle of nowhere as having really great viewing. And I know it's probably nothing compared to what you can view on the daily in, like, Brooklyn or LA or whatever, but I'm always pleasantly surprised. I think those museums that are often state-funded kind of have to appeal to a wide range of people. So there's always a really good amount of contemporary and classic stuff, which I always gravitate more towards the contemporary. I always love it when there's a design kind of element, especially having worked at a gallery. Just the whole layout and design is very, it captures my interest, thinking about the logistics of how they rolled everything out.
No, and we've been traveling more around the area recently, and I've been feeling a similar thing where, like, these cities I don't expect to have excellent museums keep doing it, and I keep being surprised. We went to Cincinnati fairly recently, and we hit up, like, three museums, three galleries in 2 days or something. And
Cincinnati
is
surprisingly
quite
good. Yeah.
Like, you know, not that I had negative expectations of Cincinnati necessarily, but
totally.
Like, it blew out what I could have expected. And it seems like there's something to, I don't know, it almost seems like these cities that are not as quote unquote touristy are maybe cultivating stuff for the people who live there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't fully formulated, and I would need to talk to, like, more people who live in these places.
Yeah.
But, like, we just went to St. Louis, and the St. Louis Art Museum is fabulous.
That's next on our list, I think, for, like, weekend trips. I was trying to think of a particular – all of my particular examples are leaving my mind, so I'll keep it vague.
the Hunter in Chattanooga is quite good.
I'm just trying to think. But we saw a really, really great exhibit – on our Carolinas trip, I'll just say, that was about, like, votive art and these folk-crafted figurines and things that were originally kind of, like, more colonial religious figures. And then the people who were living in the area, I think it was, like, South America, started appropriating those ideas and were kind of at one point employed to create these hand-whittled iconography, like nativity scenes, three wise men, kind of different, like, religious figures like that. And that was really interesting to kind of see the antiquity merged with the modern.
So you mentioned having sort of the gallery site now, having worked in galleries when you go into them. How is that something you feel like you have to turn off in some way when you go into a gallery, like seeing how the sausage is made?
Not really. It's just exciting. And I know that every gallery does it differently. So I'm never really have like a huge expectation. I only worked in one gallery and have been a visitor of galleries and museums for the longest time. Growing up in Minneapolis, too, one of my favorite places is the Walker. I used to go there as much as I could. And that was very inspirational because it was very like high level but minimalist at the same time. I feel like I get excited more so thinking about how they rolled out the show and the process of the work. I always get very nervous when it's a ton of artists in one show because I think logistical nightmare. But thinking about that kind of stuff for me is kind of like funny and interesting and adds to the experience.
Yeah, it's like anytime we go to the Frist, I always think about like the fact of how many of the walls are movable,
Oh my God.
And like how did they decide whether we're going clockwise or counterclockwise this time?
Yeah. And just the amount of like manpower that it takes to get everything looking like pristine takes a lot of work to make it look like nobody was there, I would say. So always impressed. It's an amazing space. Like I feel like Nashville has its name on the map definitely for a multitude of things now, but knowing that we're a city that uplifts art and has a really, really good space and a beautiful historical building at that for an institution of artworks, like with a wide variety of shows too, they have really blown out of the water the last few years, especially with what they've been showing. I've been very impressed. So yeah, I love the Frist.
And it's obviously always strange to some people. This came up on my episode with one of the Frist curators several months ago. How it's weird that they don't have a permanent collection. They're technically not a museum in that sense. But for the folks who live here, it's pretty great that there's new stuff all the time.
Yeah. And the branding is amazing. The branding was done by a studio in New York that I really admire called Pentagram. And so whenever I'm visiting an institution, if there's something like that that pushes it over the edge from being just a place to display the art to really empowering the community through like a strong identity is very fascinating to me. And they really stuck with like the true Art Deco core of the Frist, kept it contemporary. They kind of hit all the marks.
So one of the other instances where your art can be seen in town is Soho House.
Correct.
You made what, 40 pieces for them or something?
I think it was closer to 20 something. There was an acquisition of multiple pieces for the common spaces, some of which are displayed, some of which were allegedly sent to a location in New York.
One of the other Soho houses.
One of the other of the network, Soho Homes. my work made this Soho House a Soho Home. So some of them, I don't really know where they're at, but they were acquired by Soho House Nashville or Soho House as a greater entity. But then I was, in addition to those acquisitions that I had already created, the curator had me create, I think it was 20 commissions for the bedrooms. And they were smaller. And they were all very, very similar. So they all had a similar theme, a similar style, were pretty easy to knock out overall, but a really cool opportunity because at that point I had not done a ton of commissions and I definitely had not done one at that scale.
Yeah, and that's what I was wondering was how you approach that scale, like how you fall into a rhythm with that many different pieces.
Luckily, they wanted them to be all very similar at that point, which I think the work that I create currently has some hints of still lives, but it has evolved a little bit beyond still lives. At that point in time, I was really, really locked in on doing still lives. We had just kind of come off of the pandemic, and I had a really strong sense of my domestic life, where I was at that point, just because I was home all the time, as we were. So they wanted still lives that had kind of that whimsical illustration doodly type feel to them. So she just kind of gave me the sizes, the amount that they needed, and the deadline, and then was like, I trust you and go for it, which is a little scary. I think depending on the kind of person that you are, that's really empowering or very daunting.
Oh, yeah.
So I just kind of chose to look at it as if I was like managing a design project and went from the deadline and kind of worked backwards and threw together some really fun, whimsical still lives.
Mm. So back to the Elephant Gallery show, back to Family Mythologies. How did that theme start to manifest?
I was very intrigued by this idea of somebody from our familial past named Roxania. We only have like one photo of her. She's very mysterious. I've been calling her the mysterious matriarch. We do not know much about her aside from this one photo and a little bit of information that's online. I really got the concept initially indirectly from my dad because he was drawing her a lot and he drew a postcard of her face and the line work and the imagery was just capturing to me. And it still hangs on my fridge, but I ended up getting a tattoo of that. And I was just kind of thinking about her a lot as like this kind of wisdom figure or like this like matrilineal kind of figure that in more of like a spiritual esoteric way, like looks down on us from wherever she is at now. And I kind of wanted to start exploring more of those archetypes and whether or not they existed within our family knowledge or not. So started looking at a lot of old family photos and kind of trying to learn about people in those photos and who they were, whether or not what we knew about them was entirely true. And the truth at that point didn't necessarily matter to me. We had an idea that Roxania was potentially the daughter of a medicine man. So that's just kind of like an intriguing concept that I didn't even really explore that concept directly, but just had me thinking about her quite a bit. Who is she like? What would she be like if I knew her now? And then that trickled into other family members. Like my grandmother on both my mom and my dad's side, I'm the youngest of the youngest, so didn't know her too well. I only really know either of them through super limited interaction and family stories. So once again, with them, I started like drawing them and just thinking about them, thinking about who would they be under like modern context? Who would I be under, you know, the context of when they were born as like a person, as a woman? Where would I fall? So I kind of just started thinking about the archetypes of our lives, where we fall, where we're going, where we come from, who we become in like a very vague way, but then trying to apply that to limited anecdotes and almost like funny family phrases or stories that go about our household.
Yeah. Has that altered your relationship with the idea of your family, do you think? Or has it just like sort of actualized what was already there?
I think actualizing is a good way of putting it because it is just limited to what we know and what we remember. Like not none of them, I won't say they're untrue, but a lot of stories or family anecdotes that we have, they've been kind of through like generations of like sifting, if that makes sense. We have details that matter and details that don't. We potentially know that my mom had like a great uncle or something similar who was a Texas Ranger. So you start to think of the Texas Rangers and their story throughout like American history and their intensity, cool outfits. I started reading a lot of Wikipedia pages of like time periods and places that I could kind of connect me or my family to in like a really, really vague way. But I did kind of want to dive into like just a very like broad understanding of where they came from without getting kind of the whole point of the show was that I wasn't letting myself get caught up in details because they're just paintings. They're not truth. They're not untruth. They're just kind of like an avenue of exploration.
Yeah, and there are people, these are paintings about people that you're never going to meet or meet again.
Yeah.
Right? So like what you take from their stories is perhaps more important.
Correct.
At this
and
point.
Ultimately our identities and things like that are like what drive us, but we think of ourselves in the context of like everyone who has come before us and also kind of like in future generations, like if you want kids or whatever, or you have kids or you have like smaller cousins, you just kind of think where it's like a tale as old as time. Think about where your family name has come from and where it's going to drive the next generations.
I was going to say, in terms of like moving forward, has this at all informed sort of how you want to affect the people around you? Like thinking about these other people's legacy, does that inform what you want to be?
That's a really good question. Great question. And something that I have not quite approached, I think, because I'm still hot off the trail of creating the artwork. And I do feel like I always have a different perspective of what my concept was and what I was thinking of while making the artwork. Mm. And I think it was a great place for me to start that conversation within myself. Mm. The show really does feel like you're walking into a conversation that I've been having with myself for the last year or so. So whether or not those concepts come across clearly or not, I don't necessarily know if that matters, because once again, it's all about the viewer, and I want people to think about their own context, where they come from, how they affect others. And I think with me just internalizing and finishing the work and going beyond the work, absolutely, it's going to affect my output, I guess.
And in terms of like a viewer looking at stuff, the idea that like you're not necessarily going to walk away with a conclusion that you, the artist, are trying to give the viewer. Like they're bringing themselves to it. Right?
Correct.
This is a conversation I was having with a friend about Hayley Williams recently, where I feel like she is a master of unresolved emotion, where like so many of her songs are about things that are ongoing, things that are unresolved, and yet the songs don't feel unresolved, right? They feel like a clear snapshot of that feeling.
Yeah, and I love the idea of creative windows kind of being a vignette of someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whether from my painting show, you take, like, direct concepts of familial ties, or, like, whether or not you, like, take lessons from that, and if they're literal, like, that doesn't mean as much to me, is that the pieces are literal. That's why I appreciate that I was able to go beyond like graphic design for something like this and go beyond quote unquote like truth or visual truth. I wanted them to just feel like they're capturing a moment, much like songs capture more of a moment, and maybe they're musically resolved. They kind of linger within your psyche and create your world view based on what you're consuming.
Yeah.
They take you into thinking about your life or your transformation or your output in many different ways.
So do you associate graphic design with sort of more concrete truth?
I think I do, which maybe now, since it's such a saturated market, that isn't as important or not. I know when advertising kind of became like this huge industry, you know, the like golden age of advertising, I think there was a sense of truth, whether or not that truth was like moral or correct or
it's
not.
It's constructed, right?
Correct. Yeah. It's a constructed truth. You want to buy something, you should buy something. And then as we go on, we learn that some of those things that we thought were so good for us or what we wanted so deeply were like cigarettes. They were like the most advertised thing ever, and now we know how horrible they are for us. So I think the sense of truth within graphic design is like dissolving a little bit.
Mm.
But in my own practice, art has been a way for me to get away from the more work, like disciplined, oriented side of things.
So talking about painting specifically, are there specific mediums of paint that you have gravitated toward? How many sort of styles have you sort of flirted with?
Well, I've done like all the basics from like you start, you know, as a kid with like tempera paint and mixing those. And then maybe you're in a more high level art class in high school and you have to learn oil painting and learn the basics of that and kind of the basics of the masters. At least that was my trajectory. When I stopped when I no longer had painting assignments, I got rid of my oil paints. I was so sick of them and so over them. And I entirely stopped painting for a while, but then started gravitating more towards acrylics just because they're so quick to dry. And it's just like a very, like I said, kind of accessible like way to paint and create imagery. I could just put something down. I knew it would dry in 5 minutes. If I didn't like it, I could paint over it. I'm a very like rash, like immediacy type person. So I think the acrylics worked well with that. But I wanted to start adding quite a bit more texture into what I was doing. So I intentionally started a practice of building up the painting surfaces more so than just paint on canvas. So I'll do a lot of collaging behind the work, or I will lay out sand and glue and get it to be like this really gritty textural like landscape before I even start drawing on the canvas or like creating a concept for the work. And now that I say that, now that the show is over, I would really love to try oil paints again and kind of embark. Now that I know that I can like create a whole show and I can create concepts, like what if I slow it down and I let myself be frustrated by the drying time of oil paints and see how I can kind of use it to my advantage. And I've also kind of, just as like a quick little exercise, have been doing some more watercolor doodles recently. Just for like a quick pen to paper, hand to paper, mind body connection.
Yeah, and you mentioned several times wanting to sort of get back to a place of like pure doodling, just like, I guess, pure expression to to some degree. How much of what you do for like paintings, things that you intend to be a finished piece rather than like doodling, is like pre-planned from a sketch versus the canvas is in front of me, here we go?
I do just a lot of little, like, thumbnail drawings. Like, I grew up drawing. I was, like, the kid that drew the eye on, like, every single assignment in the margins, if you kind of know what I'm talking about. Always drawing on the bulletins at church. Always in the pew with a pen in my hand. I always start with a doodle. Even if it evolves on the canvas into something that looks completely different, which, because of my, like, the way that I gravitate towards immediacy and just, like, quick reactions, a lot of times it'll change as I'm painting the piece. I don't really stick to, like, an official, or at least I try not to let myself think that I have to stick to an official layout. There are pieces that have followed through from doodle to painting that are closer to the doodles, especially when I was doing still lives. I think those were kind of a little bit closer just because I was kind of trying to see what I could make happen from the paper to the canvas. And recently I've been letting myself out of color outside the lines, so to speak. And I've been incorporating some more oil pastel. So there have been times where I've totally finished the piece as it looks as the doodle, but then I want to add some more life to it. So then I'll go in and try and just like give it some more spark.
How do you know when to stop? Because this is the thing I think about with painting, and that I've heard from people about paintings, is that like it seems very easy to add too much, right?
It's so easy to overwork a painting.
Yeah.
We used to always get so frustrated with my dad when he would paint, because he would paint something that us as the viewer or as just the other people living around the artwork were like, that's awesome. Like, that's not a concept I had. You got it onto the canvas. It looks gorgeous. Just say it's done. But now that I have been prepping for the show where I know people are going to see the work, I've had to catch myself from overworking things because I do think, because we have this very, like, I mean, I work hourly. We have this very capitalistic idea that the more hours you put into something, therefore the more like financially worthy you are or the piece is, et cetera. So I've been trying to actively take a step back from finishing the work or just letting it look. I would rather work at this point look and feel more unfinished and more spirit-filled rather than feel like I squeezed all the life out of it. So that's an everyday battle.
It's interesting because for me it works the opposite way, where my productivity gremlin brain is the faster I get this thing done, the more efficient it is.
Yeah. Okay, right? Yeah. I totally hear that perspective as well. Like, you don't want to – if you were making it for a client or whatever, you wouldn't want to waste their money or waste their time. It is such a fine balance between, like, looking at the piece, how you feel about the piece, what – if you are making something for a client, what their stipulations are and what boxes you have to check for a piece or for a design brief or whatever. Yeah, that's an answer that I don't have because it's like – I feel like it's different for every piece and it's different for every person.
Yeah, and this is a concept that I haven't really thought about for many episodes since I talked to someone on here last about it. But the idea that creativity is a relationship with yourself. And so,
hardest relationship you'll ever have.
Yeah, and like how that means you have to listen.
Yeah.
Both to the self that is making and the self that appears in the made thing.
And I also studied a bit of photography in school. I feel so bad because I am probably misquoting phrases and things throughout this whole podcast. But like I said, I'm not somebody who necessarily seeks the truth, more so the feeling and like what you can glean from something. So I've heard a phrase quite a bit. I think it's very popular in the photography world. It's like you're making three pieces whenever you're taking a photograph, or you can sub in making a painting or whatever. Making a piece, you're making three pieces. One is the photo, and I'll talk about it in the context of photography, taking three photos. One is the photo you want to make, the vision that's in your head. The second is the photo you think you're making, because especially if you're using film or you're looking at the viewfinder, you're going to be seeing what isn't necessarily on the film yet. And then the third is the photo that you actually make. The piece that the outcome is ultimately never going to look exactly like what you have in your head or exactly what you think you're doing in the moment. But being able to be open with yourself and have that conversation with yourself, which, like I said, is the hardest, probably like the hardest conversations you're ever going to have are internally.
Yeah.
Just keeping that in mind, that there is like room for human error and that those expectations are always shifting, are things that I keep in mind in order to keep myself going. Sometimes you just have to finish a piece and move on to the next because it's never going to be what you wanted. Sometimes you're pleasantly surprised, but it is like a difficult, and I think it should be a difficult process for everything that you make.
Yeah, and trying things is hard, but so important, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think all the time about there are these things that people say to you that they probably don't remember saying and that you think about every week.
Yeah.
And my best friend in high school, a guy named Charles, we were in band together, both school band and like our garage crappy rock band, ran and writing songs together, mostly separately. And as a result, the first time I told him that I wrote a song and didn't like it, he said, good, you finally started writing enough.
Yes.
That you don't like something you made.
Yes. And it's that like that thing where you have to like know all of the rules and like abide by all the rules to the point where you're like, I'm going to burst. Like, if I have to follow the rules and that means writing a song that I don't like, I've gotten to the point where I can advance. If you've made like enough pieces where you get to the point where you hate everything that you're painting, it probably means that there's room to advance or switch up or change or experiment.
Yeah.
And it's like a ladder that you're constantly climbing.
You're feeling growing pains in your process.
In the best way possible.
Yeah. And that's why I really like the fact that you sort of recognized that you might like go off and try oils again.
Yeah.
Now is the idea that that would be a process. Right?
Yeah.
A new process to embark on and try.
Yeah.
Is I've been in a strongly, how do I like the process? How do I make myself enjoy the process?
Yeah.
Is something someone on the internet said recently that's been living in my brain.
Yeah.
Is the idea that you don't write a book to have a book. You write a book to have written a book.
Yes.
For that experience and exploration. And like.
Definitely.
My brain said, but that's not why I do it. I want the thing to exist. I want the end result to be in the world.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think like. Again, I mentioned like kind of the saturation of like everything on the internet. Like everyone is doing everything. I think there's a lot of people who see that are like, oh, I see the result of somebody's efforts in being a cool musician. Mm. So therefore, I want to be a cool musician. But if you don't enjoy the process of collaborating and creating music with these people, you're not ever going to get like a result that's favorable. And I say that from experience because I was in bands in high school and I was like, I love music, I love bands, I love the idea of performing. I actually hated the days where I had to get on stage and perform. I hated the days where I had to sit down and write songs. Mm. And that's how you ultimately know that, like, something isn't for you. Like, if you start engaging with the process and it's just not, like, what is, to be cliche again, filling up your cup.
Yeah.
Like, you're never going to get anything favorable from that.
Yeah, follow the fun, follow the fulfillment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that fun and fulfillment does include, like, really sucking at doing something initially.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm ready to start sucking at oil paints again.
Well, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was fun.
And, of course, go check out Blythe's show at Elephant Gallery. It will be open now by the time you're hearing this episode through December 20th.
Yeah. And you should come and view it.
Yeah, support local art scenes because we have a lot of good art scene here.
Nashville has been surprisingly fruitful in terms of art, other makers and viewers and art appreciators, patrons. I have been pleasantly surprised with it not being a quote-unquote official like or cultural art city. You know, everyone calls Nashville a music city. There are so many makers that make their living in kind of that like audio visual space working with other musicians. But there really is so much talent that is just like teeming under the surface in Nashville. So get to your gallery, get to your library, read some books, view some art. The end.
Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. That was awesome.
And thank you all for listening. As always, the show is brought to you because of the Nashville Public Library. So, whether you're in Nashville or beyond, find your public library, get a library card, and use it. Because the best way to support your public library is to let it support you with all those goods and services they offer. Bet there's more than you think. Thank you very much.